first of all, welcome everybody. Princey, and everybody's familiar. So I just wanted to say I hope everybody had wonderful Chagim. Most of you saw over the Chagim, but those who didn't, I hope it was wonderful. But we're going to pick it up with Mishlei. We'll discuss just one pasuk tonight and explore three different interpretations of the pasuk. All of which I think are very illuminating. And they have to do, the common denominator between the three of them is self-knowledge, learning about ourselves and listening to ourselves. So people here, anybody here know Socrates' famous comment?
Yeah,
that's correct. Here, we just pass this down. Don, you say a little while?
The unexamined life is not worth living.
Very good. Very good. And see, I wasn't even that fits in perfectly, even though I wasn't even thinking about that one. What's the other quote of Socrates that's relevant here? But we'll combine it with Don's. What did Socrates mean by the unexamined life? He meant, as he said, all knowledge is self-knowledge. All real knowledge is knowledge of the self. So Marilyn, go ahead.
Okay.
So it's very important to a person to think about what it is they're feeling and to be related, to understand what they're feeling. Religiously, it's very important. It's important in our interactions with each other. And this pasuk that we're going to study tonight is really a comment. It's a multi-layered comment about understanding ourselves. We all walk around all day. I'm including sitting down for now. It doesn't really matter yet. I don't have to be walking. And you know, we all have our thoughts. And sometimes you're talking to people. But even when you're talking to them, you could be thinking things that you're not exactly saying. I don't mean just thinking about things that aren't exactly on the topic. I mean just, you know, thinking thoughts. Oh, hi, Ruth. You know, you're thinking. And we experience life in that sense so privately. So even if we're sharing with other people, what percentage of our thoughts are we actually sharing with them? Susan, Bonaventure?
5%.
5%, maybe, right? And not even if, and I'm not even talking about people who are very cautious and, you know, are extreme discretion and hardly say anything at all. I mean, just in general, life is experienced so much privately, and that's again part of the power of the religious experience, is that the only entity who really knows everything that we're thinking and feeling is Hashem. That's what we say, Hashem is Yodea Machshavos. He really sees and feels everything that we feel and think. So this needs to be explored, the notion of self-knowledge, of the inner voice. If you take a look at the pasuk that we're going to discuss today, it says as follows. It's a pasuk from the 14th chapter of Mishlei. Lev yodea maras nafsho. A heart knows its own sorrows. A person's heart knows its own sorrows. And then the end of the pasuk. Uvisim chaso lo yisarev zar. And in its joys no outsider shall take part. Now we'll explore what exactly this pasuk means, but we'll break it up now part by part. A heart knows its own sorrows. Anybody want to venture an interpretation? What does it mean? Lev yodea maras nafsho. A heart knows its own sorrows.
You know your own pain.
Exactly. That the experience of suffering is a very private experience. Even if multiple people are, are sitting in the same prison cell, does that mean that they know exactly what the other person is experiencing? No, they probably have a better chance of relating to, in Sharansky's memoir about his time in the gulag. So he writes about his cellmates, and he talks about the bonds, you know, between them. Very profound bonds, because they understood each other in a way that very few people on the outside could. But nonetheless, he talks about how much they suffered privately, how, you know, each of them, they were living in the same cell, but they were living differently and separately. And Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, the experience of suffering is something that really is a very internal one. And as much as you can share with another person, let's take Susan's ratio, a huge percentage, the overwhelming majority, is never going to be communicated outside. That's the first part of the pasuk. Lev yodea maras nafsho. The heart knows what it's going through. Ubisimchaso lo yisarev zar. And likewise, when it comes to joy, no outsider can truly take part in one's joy. Now, this is a little less obvious. I see Seal already grimacing. So go ahead. No, please. I was hoping somebody would grimace, but not for long. This isn't meant to be a painful experience.
Understand when you say that, a person knows his own suffering. That's a given.
Yes.
You give your own pain.
Right.
But I think sometimes when a person is joyful and happy and glad, I think you can let outsiders share.
100%.
You go to a wedding, you go to an affair, and you want all your friends and relatives to share in your joy.
100%.
So I don't understand that you say no outsiders shall take part.
Excellent.
Well, I think what it's telling you is exactly the truth, meaning no outsiders have to depart. That's reality. That's the reality. But
that meaning other people are not going to.
That is reality. No outsiders shall take part, meaning that's the reality in Golos. Maybe afterwards it's not, but right now, no outsiders shall take part. It's telling you this is the reality.
Okay, it's describing. Okay, so we're going to, I agree that it's, that Seal is correct to point out that joy is normally, we think of it as a kind of infectious emotion. Just hang on to that. Cause I think that's an excellent, question. I think we're going to have to explain what exactly Shlomo HaMelech meant here when he said, "Uvisimchaso," when a person rejoices, "Lo yisarev zar." And Donnie's suggesting that, look, maybe it's just a reality. People aren't really rejoicing for each other, but we'll have to hold off on a complete answer for now. Okay, so for the first part of the shiur, we're just going to work on the first half of the pasuk, which is Lev Yodea Maras Nefsho. A heart knows its own suffering. There's a kind of self-knowledge that we respect. A person understands things about themselves that nobody else can understand. Now, this actually comes up halachically in a very important context. If you take a look at the first source, this comes up in the very end of Maseches Yoma, which is the Talmud's tractate, which deals with the halachos, the practical halachos of Yom Kippur. The first seven prakim deal with the sacrificial offerings, which are not practical today. So the eighth chapter deals with the practical laws of fasting and the things that we can't do on Yom Kippur. So as everybody knows, there's a fast which applies both to men and women on Yom Kippur, and it's a very serious fast. The punishment for not fasting when one should be fasting is kares, a very serious punishment. So the Gemara says as follows in Source 1. Chola, if a person is sick, and here you have the translation here which I wrote up. I'll read in the Hebrew and I'll translate, but if you prefer to follow in the English, of course, that's fine. Chola, if a person is sick, ma'achilin oso al pi bikiyin. What's that? Yeah. So if a person is sick on Yom Kippur, they need to consult experts, because just as a person has an obligation to fast on Yom Kippur, a person has an equal and overriding obligation to look after their own health. So if a person is in a serious health situation, comes up every year on Yom Kippur, personal experience, they have to consult halachic authorities, medical authorities, and make the appropriate decision. That's the introduction. Amar Rabbi Yanai, chola omer tzarech. Let's say you have a person who is seriously ill, and he says, you know what, I need to eat. I don't think I'm going to be able to make it fasting on Yom Kippur. It won't be good for my health. It doesn't mean that he's going to die. It means just that it will be injurious to his health. Virofe omer eino tzarech. But you have the top doctor from New York Presbyterian who says, no, he actually can fast. I assessed it, I'm an expert. So who do you listen to? You would have thought that you should listen to the doctor, because he's the expert. The Gemara says, no, shomin l'chola, that halachically speaking, who is the authoritative voice in this case? The sick person. Why? Our pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho. A heart knows what it's going through. You can have all the medical knowledge in the world, you can have all the tests in the world, you can have all the lab results in the world, but you can't be inside a person's heart. And we believe that there's a kind of self-knowledge which is more powerful than any other kind of knowledge. The Gemara goes on to say, really one of my favorite lines, Mar Bar Rav Ashi Amar. Hi.
Hello.
Oh.
That's what they're saying downstairs.
Oh. These malicious rumors that they're spreading. Oh, no.
Yeah, the guy at the front is telling the old, I don't know his name, the closet at 7.
No.
He has the old thing.
Yeah, I told him many, many times.
They corrected it online, but
and it's I, and, but I'll just say, let me get Ellen a chair before I...
There's one right there.
So, but I was commenting to people before that it was an honest mistake that I was trying to encourage them to correct. But it's like umpires or referees at a sporting event. You know, nobody ever notices them unless they make a mistake. Right. So I've been here for 5 years. And this is the first time they make a mistake. So it's like what I really have to say is you have to be thankful for the 5 years where nothing ever went wrong. That's really, if a person makes one small mistake, everybody, So anyway, we want to thank the office for being right 99.9% of the time. That's really the message. So all we've said so far is that we're talking about the power of self-knowledge. Shlomo HaMelech, just to review quickly, has a pasuk where he says that Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, a person knows their own suffering in a way nobody else can. Even if you tell somebody, they might hear the words and they could be the most empathetic person in the world, but a heart suffers in its own unique private way. And so therefore, in the context of Yom Kippur, we said that a person who is seriously ill and it's questionable whether he should fast or not, and you have the brightest doctors in the world saying, no, he can fast, the halacha is that he doesn't need to fast if he doesn't think that he can fast. And we're just at the end of source one. Marbar of Ashi says, who's one of the Amoraim, Kol hecha de'amar tzarech, ani, as long as the sick person says, I need to eat, I can't fast, afilu ika meya de'amri lo tzarech, even if there are 100 doctors. Now it's not just you versus the doctor, but the doctor says, you don't believe me? And he gets all his friends, and he flies them in for a medical conference, and they all, protest, and say, this person should be fasting, it's Yom Kippur. But he says, no, I really don't think I can do it. And I'm not talking about somebody who's being a wise guy or he just has a cold. But this is a person who has a reason for saying it. The halacha is you follow the sick person against 100 doctors, against 1,000 doctors, against 1,000,000 doctors. That's the halacha. Why? It's all based on one pasuk in Mishlei of Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, is that a person feels pain in a way that nobody else can understand and experience. Suffering is a very private and personal experience. And it's not just the Gemara that says this, but people should just know that this is the halacha. This is actually how we pasken. I just showed you the Shulchan Aruch in source 2, but this is halacha l'maisa. If a person says, who's seriously ill, and it happens every year, you speak to the job of the rabbi is to speak to the doctor and to speak to the patient. And if the doctor says one thing and the patient says another, you listen to the patient. Now, I should just note that if the person is being a martyr, Brian, do you mind? I don't want to make you work. Do you mind just helping people with the chairs? Okay. Thank you so very much. Brian is a very good person. Brian, you shouldn't. You don't have to sit. This is not. You're not in. You don't have to sit in exile. We've all been exiled once already.
Right.
We don't want to... What's that? Okay. See, Brian is...
We wanted the building together.
What about the reverse?
I
saw this here at the Jewish Center many years ago, where a person is very assisted with the medicine. He has to take medicine, and it's injurious to his health. And that's why the lamb came off the beam. I went over to the person and told him the silly war by fasting.
I love Rabbi Lamb. He does it in a way nobody else does. Arthur, it was such a good question. I'm just going to hold off till Brian finishes setting up. Rabbi Lamb, that's the right answer, and I'll repeat the question. But Rabbi Lamb said it so well. He's so good. Man. I'm not sure. I have to decide. Sometimes I ask myself, would it be worth getting, like, if I could go in a time machine and go back to the 1960s, I probably wouldn't, except that I could be a congregant here and have Rabbi Lamb as my rabbi.
Even the 70s.
All right. I'd be willing to go back to the 70s.
576.
Yeah, he's the nicest. He's really such a lovely person. I love that story. You know, and he's moving back.
I know.
Yes.
He's moving. He's moving back to the neighborhood.
Back to the hood.
The return of Rabbi Lamb.
87.
It's the return of Rabbi. It's going to be great. He was like down in the 70s, right?
He was in
70th and 70th and Central Park. He was in 70th and Central Park.
BYU apartment. Practically a different state.
Because they were both having trouble walking, they went, didn't come here often. As often as they would have liked,
and they had a duplex.
Well, that was why they moved.
Because they had the problem with the steps in the apartment.
But they couldn't come here. They were going to the S&P office. He's coming back.
We're excited. Okay, so Arthur asked a really good question. So what I said just now is that, let's say, because we believe this pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, a person has authority over any physician or any team of physicians or any union of physicians. A person knows his suffering in a unique way. So Arthur just asked a very important question. What about the reverse case? Let's say the doctors are saying this is not safe. A person should not be fasting. He's saying, no, I can do it. So the halacha is that the person has to eat in that case, because we're concerned that the person really isn't thinking clearly. This has happened, I've seen this happen, unfortunately, many times. Two Yom Kippurs ago, I was giving this shiur. I usually give a shiur during the break on Yom Kippur between Musaf and Mincha. And there is a woman, a wonderful, wonderful person, who is a very brave person, but with a lot of there were some medical issues, and I told her before Yom Kippur. I told her a week before. I told her 6 days before. It was like, I was nudging her every day. You're not allowed to fast. You're not allowed to fast. She said, I'm fasting. You're not allowed to. It's not a question of, or can you? You're not allowed to. The doctors say you can't. So comes the break on Yom Kippur. I start the shiur. 2 minutes in, and she faints. So thankfully, Nancy Sklarin was there. But that's the halacha, is that if a person says, I can, and the doctors say you can't, we don't risk it. Because again, when any time you have a suffix nefashos, then we always are very, very careful. Eddie Lowenthal took good care of her. That's a Yom Kippur. I spoke to her. She's doing great. She listened this year.
To what extent do you force that person to take if they're resisting?
Well, you see, Rabbi Lamb was the best story. I was so happy that Arthur just told this story, that Rabbi Lamb got off the bima and started, shaking his fist and saying, you're sinning more by fasting. So Rabbi Lamb didn't start wrestling with the person. I presume that they were already sick.
But somebody had to go and tell Rabbi Lamb what the situation was.
Right. Oh, I can just tell you one other story in that respect. It's like Ted saying, how far do you go? So there was a cholera epidemic in the early 20th century in a particular part of Eastern Europe where Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, was the rabbi. And he was concerned that people would be foolish and fast, even though the whole community was in a suffix nefashos because of the cholera epidemic. So after Kol Nidre, he ate publicly in shul. So you have to do whatever you can. There are always going to be people who think it's a bigger mitzvah to risk their lives, and you can't wrestle them, and maybe Ted says we should, but there's some limit, but you have to do everything in your power to encourage them and to teach them, at the very least. Okay, so that's the first meaning of this Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, that there's a special kind of self-knowledge in halacha which trumps any kind of expert or medical knowledge. This is, I think, one of the most beautiful expressions of the idea that, as we started with that quote from Socrates, that all knowledge is self-knowledge, that we really believe that there's a special power to a person's self-knowledge, an inner voice. The second meaning of this, this is in section 2, what I call the voice of conscience, just as there's a self-knowledge in the medical context, we believe in self-knowledge in the moral sense. And what I mean by that is as follows. If you take a look at source 3, this is a beautiful medrash.
Self-knowledge, like, wouldn't you say a lot of our patriarchs, everyone was just basically, through self-knowledge, it was obviously spiritual knowledge, that they grew to low lengths of whatever, in some cases, prophecy, some whatever.
Yeah,
through self-knowledge. I mean, there was no exterior. It was just them.
Yeah. Oh, so let me just make a distinction. Yeah. With Don, let me just clarify. What Donnie's talking about is a different kind of self-knowledge. Donnie's like taking the self-taught people who are able to derive things on their own. Avram was a classic example of somebody who derived the most important truth on his own, which is a very important kind of self-taught knowledge. And what I'm talking about right now is a slightly different kind of self-knowledge, not knowledge that one acquires oneself, self-taught, but knowledge of oneself, self-knowledge in that sense. So just as there's a special kind of self-knowledge in the medical context, that's why the chola has more halachic authority than the doctor in the context of Yom Kippur, if you take a look at source 3, we believe in the self-knowledge in a moral and ethical sense as well. So the Medrash says as follows: Halev hu shemivayish es ha'adam. The heart sometimes embarrasses a person, which means there's such a thing in this world as shame. Lama sheyodeya ma'asa. A person knows what they did. He did something that's wrong. Umisbayish me'atzmo, and a person feels shame. We're not talking about sociopaths where this is impaired, or a person is not able to feel any shame. That's a very dangerous thing. But in a healthy person, you can fool a lot of people a lot of the time. People can, and they do, but you really can't fool yourself. The halacha believes that there's a certain kind of voice in a healthy person which knows when you've done something wrong. Lekach ne'emar, and which pasuk do they quote to prove this? Our pasuk in Mishnah, lev yodeya maras nafsho. A heart knows its own sorrows. In this, the first context we said this, suffering, this is a little bit different. Lev yodeya maras nafsho. A heart knows, a person knows their own wrongdoing, that the bitterness that they've caused themselves. And the Yalkut Shimoni here in Source 4 quotes a classical example of this from Shaul, where he believed that a person on some deep level, even if they deny it, even if they don't show any outward signs, a person in their own heart has a certain kind of moral self-knowledge. And tell the following story about Shaul. Everybody's aware that Shaul, towards the end of Sefer Shmuel, became sick. It says that there was a ruach ra'ah, which many of the commentaries interpret to mean some kind of a depression that Shaul was going through. And even though he was once very fond of David, he's the one who brought David into his house after David slayed the giant Goliath, he started to want to kill David, and David had to go on the run. So David had to look for various places to hide himself when he was running away from Shaul, and one of the places that he went to was a place called Nov, which was a city of Kohanim, and he was there briefly, and he was starving, and he was running, and they took care of him for a brief amount of time. So Shaul, instead of, people complain when, sitting presidents campaign instead of govern, so instead of governing, Shaul wasn't even campaigning, because when you're king, you don't have to worry about polls, but instead of running the government, he was chasing David around the country. So he came to the city of Nob, and he heard that they were harboring David for some time. Anybody know what happened? Ruth? Yeah, he has one of his lieutenants wipe out the entire city. There's a massacre of Kohanim in the city of Nob that Shaul was responsible for. Okay, that's the first part of the story. There's literally blood flowing in the streets of Nob. It was a very Shaul did some great things in his life, but this is really a treacherous thing. Okay, very, very end of Shaul's life. He's already been told that he's losing the Malucha. Again, what was his sin? Why did he lose the Malucha? The arch sin. It wasn't even for the city of Nov, but the arch sin that he committed.
He didn't kill Malucha.
Exactly. He failed to wipe out Amalek, and Shmuel tells him, Shmuel was the prophet in that generation who anointed Shaul to begin with. He says, your Malucha will be torn from you and will be given to somebody who's better than you, which ultimately meant David. So at the very end of his life, Shaul is surrounded by enemies, the Plishtim. And he wants to contact a prophet to figure out what his fate is going to be. But the problem is that the prophet of that time, Shmuel, had just recently passed away. So Shaul goes through this whole song and dance, and he dresses up, and he goes in disguise to contact the sorcerer. Now, sorcery is outlawed by the Torah, and Shaul had earlier in his life waged a campaign against sorcery. So all the sorcery that was taking place, it was like in barbershop fronts. You couldn't just go to a sorcerer. You had to go to some other place, which was selling pencils. And in the back, they were doing sorcery. That's what the Navi says. So he dresses up and he goes through the night and he comes to some woman who's a sorcerer and he speaks to Shmuel and Shmuel says, "Why'd you bother me? I'm dead. I'm enjoying it finally. It's hard to be a leader of the Jewish people. I finally
have it." Sorcery is the same thing as black magic.
I'm not an expert, but I would use them interchangeably. I don't know. I'm not sure that experts in the field would appreciate me confusing sorcery and black magic. To me, it's all the same.
But they talk about black magic, though, like that.
Right. So we're not supposed to do anything that relates to sorcery, black magic, any other.
This is necromancy.
Okay, necromancy, thank you. That's certainly not necromancy. That sounds even worse. No, right, exactly, because, necro from the dead. Exactly. No, that's true. Necromancy, all these things are not allowed. There's a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban about why you're not allowed to do these things. The Ramban, who is a Kabbalist, is generally of the view that these things work, but we're supposed to rely on Hashem. That's the Ramban's view. So that you shouldn't do these. And that, again, that's what the psukim sound like, because Shaul went to the sorcerer and she did her job. She was able to conjure up Shaul. So the Ramban's view is that these things work, but Jews should rely on Hashem. They shouldn't use sorcery. The Rambam has a different view. How he justifies this in light of the psukim is another story. But the Rambam says you can't do it because it doesn't work, and a Jew isn't allowed to do stupid things. Okay, that's what the Rambam said. So it's a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban. Why can't you involve yourself in sorcery, black magic, and or necromancy? Okay. Communing with the dead.
Okay. Having a seance.
Okay. Or seancing. There's a fourth term. It's all illicit. So the question is, so Shmuel gets really annoyed, obviously, about this whole thing. But he tells Shaul, he says, "Anyway, it's what I told you before. You're finished." And Shaul obviously gets very upset. And the next day is the last day of his life. He's killed in battle with the Plishtim. Okay. So the Medrash asks a very simple question. Shaul wanted to know what his fate was going to be, so why didn't he just do what he should have done, which is go to the Kohen Gadol? They had a system called the Urim V'Tumim, the special breastplate with stones on it that the Kohen wore, and they were able to communicate with Hashem through the Urim V'Tumim. So the Gemara says, well, why didn't Shaul do that? Anybody want to anticipate the answer?
Because
when he looked at the Urim V'Tumim, all he could see was it's Lady Macbeth with the blood, right? So all he could see was the blood in the streets of Nov. He couldn't go near the Kohen. Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, even though Shaul never apologized for it, and he never showed any outward signs that he was plagued by the sense of guilt over what he did, we learned from what he was avoiding, what he was really feeling. They quote the Pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho, a heart knows. Shaul may have fooled a lot of people. If you looked from the outside, you wouldn't be able to tell what he was thinking, but you can tell by, the song and dance that he had to do, dressing up, traveling through the night to find a sorcerer, in the backwoods somewhere, that he was actually plagued. This is very important, just in the general sense, that this is actually a gift, that according to Chazal, what Chazal are saying here, that a heart has a sort of internal moral compass for all of us, is that we just have to kind of train ourselves to listen carefully. Rationalization happens pretty quickly, but if we can avoid that, then Hashem gave us an internal mechanism for doing the right thing, or at least after we do the wrong thing, to correct it. Lev yodea maras nafsho. That's what Chazal are saying, is that a heart is exactly here. Halev hu shemibayish es adam lamash yodea ma'asa misbayish me'atzmo. That one of the special properties of either the heart or the conscience, whatever term you want to use, is that a person, again, who's not a sociopath, really does know when he's done something wrong. And the challenge is, easier said than done, but the challenge is then to act on that inner voice.
Yeah, so he'd even have corrected something like that.
Right, so in this case, Shaul wouldn't have been able to correct it. But I'm just saying, in general, is that, it's really a blessing that we have this kind of self-knowledge. So what we've said so far is really we have self-knowledge in two different senses. There's in the medical sense, a person really does know on some level what their limits are, and we trust that more than 1,000 doctors. And then we also say that there's a kind of moral self-knowledge that a person, a healthy person has, is that a person really does know when they've done something wrong. And even if 1,000 people are telling you, no, you did the right thing, you were right to say that to this person, you were right to do that, if it doesn't feel right on the inside, maybe that's the voice which is ultimately worth listening to, more than the 1,000 doctors in the medical case and more than the 1,000 friends in the other case. Sometimes you just really have to listen to that instinct. It knows a little bit better than anybody on the outside if something wasn't right. So that's just a second kind of self-knowledge, which is important. Susan, yeah?
Yeah, wouldn't it have been more useful for this knowledge to kick in before you do the bad thing?
Yeah. So, and that was, I think, an excellent point that was raised, is that if you've murdered somebody, then it really is too late. But most of the time in life, it's not so egregious that you can't correct it. You know, that's one...
Isn't that the whole idea of prisons? I mean, a correctional facility that you sit there and you rot and you're kind of doing tshuva, sort of reflecting and bettering yourself? I mean... Somebody who kills somebody can't do tshuva?
Right. So a person who kills somebody, actually, they can't ever correct that which they've done wrong vis-a-vis the other person, but we actually do believe that the person can do tshuva for that. According to Rav Rambam, he only gets kapara through his own death. That's a whole story in its own right. But I should just note, in the more generally, something I've thought about a lot over the years, even though we have, as Donnie was just pointing out, I don't know if everybody heard him, he's saying, you know, taking taxpayers' money. And in our country, 1% of the population is in prison, right? So there's 300 million people in this country, about 3 million people in prison. What's so striking is that in halacha, there's really no prison. Halacha didn't really consider prison a useful institution. So that's just something to think about. One of the differences between Jewish perspective and a Western perspective, whether in Western perspective, there's really two different approaches to prison. Either it's punitive or it's meant to be corrective. It's a, as they call it, a rehabilitation facility, or they like to call it the corrections department. Okay, you know, you could ask them. I'm not an expert. How much corrections? You think of people walking around with red pens. You know, it's the corrections department. But that's what they call it. So it's supposed to have both a punitive and a rehabilitative. Halacha was skeptical of the utility of prisons. So you actually don't find any prisons in halacha. Maybe a topic for a different class. Yeah, Brian.
They threw people in prison. They didn't know what to do with them.
But there wasn't this idea of prison until much later. Yeah. 17th, 18th century. You're saying even in the... Yeah, to ancient man, it would have seemed a strange thing to do. So you're just going to kind of keep him there. So the ear McLaughlin... But the ear McLaughlin really isn't comparable to a modern prison. It's normal... It's a completely functional. Right. So a person just continues a normal life, but they're kind of, I wouldn't call it under house arrest, they're city arrest. But that's like the closest thing that we have to it, but it's a far cry from Rikers, right?
So how was the citizenry protected from murder?
Yeah, okay, so excellent question. Excellent. So they had a much shorter system for implementation. So let's put it that way. The halacha is that once the verdict is passed, the psak din, unless it's Shabbos or Yontif coming up, the psak din has to be carried out right away. So there's corporal punishment and then there's capital punishment, malchus and misa. But there's no extended. You know, you're going to sit here making license plates.
That was worse.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, and then we'll take Donnie's question. Yeah. Go ahead.
To what extent is his depression hold him accountable?
Right, okay, that's a very good point. I remember in junior high school I tried to make that, I feel very strongly about that. I'm just saying, I'm a long-standing proponent that Shaul should be at least partially exonerated. I remember this because my teacher got very upset at me. How did you say that? But I remember saying, it's because my parents are psychiatrists, so he's very sensitive to mental health issues. I don't know, but I said, no, he was depressed, he wasn't thinking clearly. That I think is a legitimate point. You see that Chazal, even though Shaul did this horrible thing, Shaul is still part of our canon. I always argued that's because we looked at him at least partially as not responsible for what he did. Now, he's partially responsible, but at least in part, he wasn't responsible, and I think that has a lot to do with his illness.
Right, but I mean, he's sane enough to reflect on
the fact that he
should feel bad.
Vishal is really one of those characters very much in a gray area where there was partial responsibility, but I would agree with you that you couldn't say that there would be complete responsibility. If there was, he would have been totally, you know, thrown out of the, people would not be naming their children Shaul today. No, but it's true. We don't look at him as a person who is responsible for the mass murder of the entire city of Kohanim would have gotten much harsher treatment if we thought he was fully accountable. Yeah, Donnie, you had a question.
No, well, I mean, I've always thought that, you know, you're talking about jail and the Gemara, you break Shabbos and you get what? Kares? I mean, the type of punishment that they talk about for mild things like breaking Shabbos, like that doesn't make sense.
Well, right. So this is let me just make the following point before we start section three: is that we're trained as people living in New York City in 2011, the type of crimes that we think about, we don't think about ritual crimes at all. If you ask us what strikes us as severe crimes, we'll immediately start listing things which are social ills: murder, rape. You know, these kinds of things, because there is no parallel to violations ben adam l'makom in New York City, right? Nobody's going to, you're not going to see people on 86th Street and Amsterdam Avenue getting lashes for, speaking Lashon Hara, it's just that it wouldn't happen, right? You can imagine there'd be, spectacle. So again, it's almost impossible for us, given the constraints of our mentality and our mindset, to imagine. So it seems insignificant to us when there is ritual violations, but again, from the perspective of halacha, which legislated things like Shabbos, these things can be very severe. Again, in our mindset, it's hard to take them nearly as seriously, right? Because we just weren't raised in that environment. But it's just important to winnow out what sort of our perspective being imposed onto the halacha. Yeah, Susan. Please.
Well, to take another example entirely, I mean, the world is in an outrage about the extreme Islam in the countries that practice it, where they are punished for these things,
right?
So
all violations of Sharia law,
yeah,
right?
It's happening today,
right? Exactly.
And the world is in an outrage because it's happening today.
Right, right. Though you find most of the time when people object, it has to do with that doesn't really matter. I think people object mostly when it has to do with things like honor killings and stonings and stuff like that. But it's true. There's clearly a difference between the Eastern and Western cultures in that respect. So far we've spoken about two different kinds of self-knowledge. Self-knowledge that's, halakhically speaking, authoritative in the medical sense, and then self-knowledge which, in the moral sense, is a great benefit to us. Person, even if the whole world is telling them that what they did is correct, if a person is uneasy about it, that's an important inner voice which should be listened to. That's another meaning of our pasuk of Lev Yodei Amaras Nafsho. A heart knows not only its own sorrows, but that which it is perpetrated. Now, Seal, where's Seal? Seal, I didn't forget your question. Seal asked a very, very good question. And it just takes us back to the pasuk, and we'll take on section 3 now. The pasuk that we read says again, Lev Yodei Amaras Nafsho, a heart knows its own sorrows, uvesimchaso, and in the joy of the heart, lo yisarev zar, no outsider shall take part. And Seal posed an outstanding question, which is, I understand the first half of the pasuk, namely, sorrow, pain really is such a private experience. Who could know, for each of us here, the different painful things built up over years and years and years, that's such a private experience. Even if another person knew factually, how could they experientially? But joy, that's something that we think is more infectious. People can share that at least more easily. What does the second half of the pasuk mean? Uvesimchaso lo yisarev zar. That when the heart actually experiences joy, no outsider can take part in that either. Okay, that was really Seal's question. Ted, go ahead.
I think the answer is built into the grammar of the piece. Simchato means his joy. He's not talking about the general joy. You go to a wedding and everybody's joyous about this happening. but for the person who's getting married, most cases, they're feeling a joy in a very different way. So I don't think it means that they can't, I think it's overstated to say they can't partake, but they cannot identify or experience it in the same way that somebody for whom it's a more significant event.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, go ahead. Well, that's very, very important.
I guess it's a different type of happiness. You could be happy for somebody, right, but it's a different type of happiness than you're experiencing that particular thing. The example, getting married. The person who's getting married experiences the joy one way, and the outsider experiences the joy for that person. It's not the same type of joy.
Okay, excellent. So two points. The first is I completely agree with what's been said. In other words, that even if Seal is correct, that joy, much more so than other kinds of emotions, does have an infectious quality. And, you know, people who smile a lot and are very optimistic, they can really raise other people's spirits. There's something unique about the experience of the person themselves, which is really what's being suggested. That's the first point. The second point is that Chazal understood this to be talking about a very specific kind of situation, not general joy, not even the unique type of experience of having something joyous happen to you, which not everybody, even if you can share that with other people, they can't experience that fully. But if you take a look here at source 5, Chazal explained the pasuk as follows, very beautifully. Lev yodei amaras nafsho, a heart knows its own sorrows, zo Chana. This is a reference to the biblical figure of Chana. Okay, Shaharbe Haisa meets the Eres, who was in great distress. What was, anybody remember Chana's distress? She wanted to be a mom. And we should just pause, you know, to appreciate that for a second. We read it every year on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, but, you know, I think for all males, it's probably something that, you know, to begin with, we have to be very humble about in terms of how much can we know exactly. But it's a very deep pain, very searing pain that Chana was experiencing. And you'll recall from the Navi that her husband, who I guess should have been the one to, you know, again, Lev Yodei Amaras Nafsho, we don't expect him to know exactly what she was experiencing. He had children. And even if he didn't have children, I doubt it would have been as acute as her pain. And anybody remember the dialogue that they had? Elkanah is the husband. Yeah.
And he basically said, you know, and he loved her more, and that should be helpful. Right. He loved her more than all her children, than she could possibly give them.
Right. So I always like to say, in the pantheon of all-time insensitive comments by men, which is stiff competition. This I always thought has a substantial candidacy for like top five. I don't know. I can't say top three. The top five. What does he say? Hello. He said she's all upset. Oh, that's Ailey. That's Ailey. Ailey thinks she's drunk because she's so intensively. Ailey is maybe top 50. She's dominating intensively. And he says, Admatai tishtakarin, hasiri neich me'alayach, until when will you drink? And she's praying, and we learn all the halachos of tefillah from her heartfelt prayer. So Ailey, that was bad enough. But the husband says, they cringe every year when they read this, she's all upset, and she can't eat, and she's depressed. And he says, sweetheart, what are you so upset about? Halo anochi tov lach me'asara banim. Am I not worth more to you than 10 children? To which she appropriately does not dignify with an answer. You can imagine that was not the right thing to say. So she experienced, unfortunately, we know this from the psukim, she experienced her pain very, very privately. Even the person who should have understood didn't understand and said a particularly egregious thing. V'hi maras nefesh, hi la'atzma, she experienced her pain by herself. That's what the first half of the pasuk in Mishlei, that's what Shlomo was referring to. Lev yodei amaras nefesho, that's telling the story of Chana. U'v'sim chaso, but then when her heart was uplifted, lo yisar yivzar. Kevan shenifgida, when Chana was remembered by Hashem, that's why we read it on Rosh Hashanah, because we talk about the zichronos, Hashem remembering. So when Hashem remembered Chana, Kevan shenifgida lo pakta Elohim ela le'atzma. the joy that she experienced was also a very private joy. Shene'emar u'besimchaso lo yis'ar yibzar. That's what the end of the pasuk in Mishlei means. It's not talking about joy in general. And I agree with Ted, with what Ted said, that joy, even general joy, is something of a personal emotion. But this is a specific kind of joy. This is joy in the wake of suffering. And only the heart that suffered, and sorrow, as we said, is such a private and personal experience. So when redemption comes to that heart, the joy that it experiences is completely, nobody could actually know what that moment of triumph is like. And Uksiv Alatz, when Chana sings her beautiful song, she says, Alatz libi b'Hashem, ki samachti b'Yeshua secha. She uses the singular language. My heart rejoices in Hashem, I rejoice in your salvation. Ani la'atzmi samachti. Only I can experience it, because I suffered by myself. It's like what we say, you know, every year on Tisha B'Av, Sisu al Yerushalayim kol ha-misablim alaha. The only people who will rejoice truthfully in the rebuilding of Jerusalem are the people who mourned over Jerusalem for thousands of years, and that's us. Specifically because pain and suffering is such a personal experience, that's why the simcha that follows that, you know, God willing, is also a private experience. That's why that's the real answer to Seal's question. Isn't joy generally infectious? Maybe so, but there's a particular kind of joy which is really reserved for the beholder of that joy, which is the joy of the one who suffered. Yes, Seal, please.
I think there may have been a question in the translation.
Sure, go ahead.
You say, the heart knows its own sorrows.
Uh-huh.
You do. But then it says, and its joys no outsider should take part.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's then the way you're describing it,
mm-hmm.
should have said, and in its joy, nobody else shall know or understand.
Right.
When you take part, you're taking part of the joy.
Yeah.
Not understanding or feeling the way you do with the suffering.
Yeah. And I think this is just a very well taken. And that's in the original Yis'arev, could probably have both of those meanings. But I agree. I think that's what emerges very well.
The kind of story has contemporary application. We know a lot of couples who are infertile and then suddenly they're able to have a child. When they have the child and there's a symptom around it. I mean,
right. And
has a special significance.
Beyond
what everybody else, all the guests are doing.
That's exactly right. Not that it needs my speaking out about it, but there is no limit to the sensitivity that we need to have. For in general in life, there are many situations which need our compassion. That's truly, truly one of the most important things that people need to be sensitive to. That's why I just tried to emphasize that what Chana's suffering was, and I'm not just speaking about the historical individual Chana, but all of the Chanas, there's just no limit. And that's exactly what the Pasuk is saying, is Lev Yodei Maras Nafsho. Nobody can know exactly what that experience is like. And not just people, even if there are many people who are in that category, each one suffers privately. It's always a personal experience. Uvesimchaso, but then God willing, when there is good news, lo yisarev zar, nobody can, even if you're incredibly happy for the person, even if you can take part, even if on some level you can share, the full measure of that joy is reserved for the person who's experiencing it. So it's just... And that's true of other situations in life as well. This same medrash goes on to quote another case, which I thought was beautiful as well. Davar acher, Lev Yodei Maras Nafsho, Elu Yisrael. This is a reference to the Jewish people, which Shlomo had in mind when it said Lev Yodei Maras Nafsho. He's actually referring to the entire Jewish people. Shehayu Nisunim B'Mitzrayim B'Shibud, that were enslaved in Egypt. The Kevan Sheba'u Latzeis, when the moment of redemption came, the Gazar Alein HaKadosh Baruch Hu La'asos Pesach, and Hashem said, okay, you're going to have a celebration tonight with the Korban Pesach, Ba'u HaMitzrim La'chol Imahem. The Egyptians wanted to come and eat with them. This is kind of interesting. It's a fascinating picture to imagine. Normally you don't imagine that. It's a picture of them, Makas Bechoros, and, there's like havoc. But, okay, there were some Egyptians who said, can we come? Let's make this the first... This was going to be the first interfaith Seder. It wasn't that they thought of these things in the 20th and 21st century. So the Mitzrim said, we'll have an interfaith Seder. It'd be great. Amar lehem ha'Elohim. So Hashem's response to that is, Chas v'shalom. Ko ben nechar lo yochobo. I only want my children, the Jewish people, to participate in the Korban Pesach. Why? So Hashem, so to speak, quoting the Pasuk in Mishlei, Lev Yodea Maras Nafsho V'Simcha Solo Yisarev Zara. I don't want anybody to experience Korban Pesach who doesn't know the true joy, the full measure of the joy of Korban Pesach. The only people who can truly enjoy the Korban Pesach for what it is, a celebration of freedom, are those who were enslaved themselves. I don't want people sort of, you know, hangers-on and, you know, fair weather. I doubt these Egyptians were coming over to the Jews' homes during the dark period of slavery and saying, oh, let's have a... No, they weren't. So you have people who are coming over now and say, wait, let's celebrate together. Korban Pesach is very special. The only people who can... Korban Pesach is not a spectator sport. The only people who can participate in Korban Pesach is the people who experientially can relate to the simcha that it represents.
What do you think was so special about the Korban Pesach?
It was the first meal. It was really the first meal that the Jewish people ate as free people. It was the type of... the famous Chazal, this Chazal well known to everybody here, that the Korban Pesach in fact represented what was the significance of the Ish Selavei Savo Selavayis, the Sa was the deity of the Egyptians, right? So that the Korban Pesach represented a triumph over the Egyptians and their ideology. And the Jewish people were acting for the first time in defiance of the Egyptians and in celebration of their freedom. So Hashem said, this is not just something, you can't just come. I want it to be special. I want it to be for the people who actually experience it for what it's meant to be, which is a redemption. And you can't, by definition, you can't experience redemption unless you know what suffering is.
Was it considered to be the first mitzvah that was performed?
It was the first national mitzvah. Yeah. We have three mitzvahs which are given in Sefer Bereishis. There's Pur Revu, be fruitful and multiply. Then there's a mitzvah of Mila. And then there's a mitzvah of Gid Hanasha. Those are the first three mitzvahs in the Torah. Then there's a fourth mitzvah, which is Kiddush HaChodesh, which was given over to the Beis Din. Moshe and Aaron were told about that mitzvah. The first national mitzvah is the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. It's a very, very important mitzvah. It's such an important mitzvah that it's one of the only two mitzvot asay in the Torah. If a person doesn't do it, they get kares. They get cut off from the people because it's like a mark of national identification. This is what Jewish people do. They celebrate their freedom. That's part of a whole longer story. But just to wrap up what we saw. Yeah, Ted, please, go ahead.
I think we've explored fully the simcha part of it. But
yes.
I want to add another point.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Lo Yedei Marat Nafsho.
Yes.
I think there are two aspects to Marat Nafsho. Mm-hmm. One is when somebody's overtly suffering, he's got cancer or whatever it is, and people will identify and sympathize with the suffering. Mm-hmm. And of course, no sympathizer can feel it the same way as the person
correct.
Who suffered. But I think there's a second point here, that people are suffering internally in ways that nobody knows about.
Correct.
And so it's not just that you can't treat it the same way, you've already gotten even aware of the piece that's there.
I think that speaks to, very eloquently speaks to the point that Seal was making at the very beginning, is that sorrow by its nature tends to be concealed. The person who's dignified is not going to announce it to the world, whereas joy, you know, again, it's just a much more infectious thing. I think Ted makes a very important contribution. It's just something that, at least in the back of our minds, we should be aware of, is that, you know, there are the tragedies with a capital T, but then there's the daily existence where people have things, you know, the things they carried and the burdens that people carry. I just want to quote a machlokas between the Rambam and the Ramban in that respect, which is, I think, very poignant one. The Rambam believes it's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray every day. The Ramban disagrees. He doesn't think that there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray every day. There's only a mitzvah d'rabbana to pray. But the Ramban will agree that there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray based tzara, that a person who's really in distress, so then it becomes a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray. And that's where the Rambam disagrees. He thinks it's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray under all circumstances. So the Rav explained the machlokas as follows. He says, no, really the Rambam agrees that it's only a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray when a person is in crisis. Except the Rambam thinks that there's a crisis every day. Mm-hmm. So everybody likes to say, yeah, because the Rav was an existentialist, so there's a crisis every day. But what he really meant is what Ted was saying, was that, of course, there are the tragedies with the capital T, and here's Hashem, those don't come up every day. But then there's also the tragedies with the lowercase T, which is the everyday crises, the everyday burdens that people carry. And that justifies prayer every day for the Rambam. That's I think the Rav meant this more homiletically, but that's exactly what Ted is talking about, the difference between the tragedies of which the Ramban spoke and the tragedies that the Rambam spoke about.
There's a number of times of prayer.
That's clearly a Durabban, and everybody agrees. Even the Rambam, who believes there's a mitzvah d'oraisa to pray every day, the number of prayers were instituted later.
So prayer should be at least once a day.
That's the only d'oraisa requirement. Just one second, is important. My sister was telling me she was framed recently. I was outraged by this. There's somebody else was talking in davening, and the teacher, she's in high school, and the teacher thought it was her, and she was sent to detention. She was later exonerated, by the way. there was a confession. I was very happy to say that there was a confession. So before there was a confession, she asked me what she should do. So I told her a number of things, and then I told her a joke. I said, you should just say, there's a particular Amora in the Gemara, Rabbi Yehuda, who says, this is before that, again, the Rambam doesn't paskin this way, the Rambam thinks the mitzvah is every day, but this Amora was very involved in his learning, so he davened once every 30 days. So I told my sister, she should tell the davening teacher that she paskins like this Amora, and that she was in one of the other 29 days. It didn't come to that, though, because she was... She was exonerated before she needed to rely on these more halakhic arguments.
But, the other girl had a guilty conscience.
The other girl, that's right. Exactly, Ellen, thank you, Olivia, damn Ross, I said, the other girl came forward. Actually, it was peer pressure at its work. The other girl rebelled against this girl, and they said, you have to confess. Elisheva is being persecuted by the davening teacher. It was good peer pressure. Yes. I was very happy to say. Okay, yes, Phil, you had a question.
That teacher supervised me.
Okay. And there were questions. Yes, questions.
I have a question about the observatory.
Yeah, of course.
There's so many, theories about if you have faith in Hashem.
Yeah.
With emuna, you really shouldn't be unhappy. You shouldn't be sorrow. That anytime that somebody has sorrow, okay, it's you're told there's a bigger plan, and this is part of it, and Hashem loves you, and it's really all for the best. So if somebody really, really believes that, then they shouldn't have sorrow. So I'm just trying to balance what we're saying about sorrow and feeling pain versus emunah.
Right, okay, so there's a balance here. The balance is crucial. On some level, it's important to recognize that they're not that it's understandable from a human perspective. That's what Hashem says to Moshe, "Kilo yirani ha'adam v'chai," and what Yeshayahu HaNavi says, "Lo machshavos ha'machshavos eichem." People don't have access to Hashem's plan for the world, and people who claim to don't usually have a good track record. People have been claiming that they understand exactly what Hashem has in mind for the world for a long time. That being the case, is that there is a very important idea on a base level, taking strength in doing all that one can, and understanding that Hashem has some bigger plan for the universe. Remember, that's what Mordechai told Esther, right? Mi yodea im le'ez kazos higat l'malchus. Maybe this, I love the way he puts it, mi yodea. He doesn't say, I know, but he says, mi yodea, who knows, maybe this is, so that, what looked like a crisis maybe is really an opportunity. Yeah, that's true on some level, but you can't forget the other side of the story, which is, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos teaches us, that it's forbidden for a person to say things to somebody like that, bishas avelo. A person's mourning, that's also legitimate. We're meant to experience things as human beings, and it's not just pragmatically a bad thing to do, but morally it's a bad thing to do. If a person is mourning and crying and suffering, that's legitimate, just because they feel that way, and it's fair. We're also human beings. The Pasuk says, "V'anshei kodesh tiyun li," you should be holy people to me. So the Kutzker pointed out, it's very important. He said, he didn't say, be kodesh to me, he said, "V'anshei kodesh." First and foremost, you're anashim, you're just people. We have a basic humanity that there's nothing wrong with experiencing pain and suffering.
And just it's also a natural human thing to say, to try and make the person feel better.
Yes, but it can be a very hurtful thing to do if it's done in an insensitive way. Just
somebody who's suffering horribly and you say, listen, that you're part of a divine plan, you don't understand
why you're trying. Not to say that.
So generally I would consider that.
I would say
that would be both. That would be both.
Getting back to El Camino.
Right. That would be both arrogant and foolish.
Right.
That's why it's forbidden.
Right. Not your part of
it. At some point, people can make their peace with things, and time makes a difference. But you have to be not just smart, but sensitive. It's just really, really important. It's important to know the Gemara in Zvachim about this. The Gemara in Zvachim says that there was a particular person whose wife passed away, who was a Kohen, who wanted to do the Avodah. He said, it's okay, it's all for part of the divine plan, and I don't want to sit in mourning, it's okay, I understand this is God's will. And the other Kohanim fired him. They said, no, this is horrible. You have to be a person, and you have to mourn.
But my focus wasn't on somebody saying that to somebody. My focus was more on, is that really true?
No, I think that's why I said Sayalakti. I think both are true, is that we're both meant to experience things on the simple human level, and then at some point meant to accept the idea that there is tzedek adin. That's why we say it at the funeral, Atzura tamim pa'oloki chol drachav mishpat, that this does somehow fit in, but we're meant to balance those perspectives. You really need both. One without the other would be inappropriate. So it's really a case where both are true. It's essential. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So I want to wish everybody a wonderful, wonderful evening. We're going to pick it up next week at 8:00.
8:00.
Okay.
Sure. And you tell them downstairs.